Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, the daughter of a wrongfully convicted death row inmate creates a foundation to help people like him and children like her. Later in the program, solving the great white shark puzzle, we talk to marine scientists before they head out on a month-long expedition northbound. But first, when Tracy Williams was just 4 years old, her father was convicted of murder and sentenced to die in the electric chair. Clifford Williams would spend more than four decades in prison before his exoneration and release. It's a story his family hopes to turn into lessons and resources for others. To talk about it, I'm joined now by Clifford Williams' daughter. Welcome, Tracy Williams Magwood.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Also joined by family pastor, Bishop Harry Williams II. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And our listeners might remember this high profile exoneration. And if you do, or if you have comments or questions, you can reach out on Facebook, Instagram, or X. You can also call us at 904-549-2937 or email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tracy, we should start, of course, with our sincere condolences. Your father passed away in January. He had some health issues that went untreated in prison. Tell us about that.
When my father first came home, less than a few months later, we discovered he had prostate cancer. And we weren't sure as far as his lifespan at that moment. Thanks to UF Shands and their Proton program, Dad overcame cancer and he was able to ring the bell and live a few more years.
Mm-hmm. He was 5 years out of prison basically before he passed. Is that right?
Today actually marks his fifth year of freedom after his exoneration.
He was released in 2019. He was wrongfully convicted along with your uncle, his nephew.
My cousin, yes.
Oh, excuse me, your cousin.
Yes.
Nathan Myers.
Yes.
And the two of them served jointly that long, long time in prison. For those who aren't familiar with your story, tell us a little bit about it. You had a very difficult childhood.
Yes. My father was my only parent. My mother died in childbirth. And so I solely depended on my father. And when I was 4 years old, he was sentenced to death for a crime that he continuously said he did not commit. So most of my childhood was behind prison bars. Oftentimes people think it's just the inmate, but it's the entire family. I remember Christmas mornings, Thanksgiving mornings, Easter mornings, weekends, going to Rayford Prison and behind those bars. I remember asking my grandmother, why can't we go there? It was the lesser institution or the place that we weren't allowed because he was on death row. So we bypassed that entrance and had to go behind multiple steel bars. I can remember those doors slamming behind me. I can remember coming into the prison and having to go through the gates as one closed and the dogs barking. I can remember people like Ted Bundy, John Spinkling, they were on death row with my dad. Mr. Riley, others that were later sentenced to death. And I remember that particular place being more of a family. I did not know the fullness of who Ted Bundy was until I became an adult, until I studied in the criminal justice field, where I later got my degree in hopes of being able to go to law school and get my dad out. A lot of times going there, it was hard to leave him. I can remember crying and asking why why can't he go with me? I can remember asking my grandmother, why does Dad have to stay? My grandmother actually became mama to me after my mom died. She and his father raised me as well as my sister and brother. And when she raised us, I was asking her, why is it that I call you mama and daddy calls you mama and he's my daddy and you're my mama? And she said, baby, that's your dad. You're my dad. You're my baby's baby. And it still didn't register to me, being a little girl, that I was being raised by my grandmother because she was mama to me. Going to the prison, people don't realize how traumatic it is for a child. I remember they had JCs and they would come and take pictures and we would get behind or get in front of a blank wall. I remember that the time came that they no longer allowed me to sit on Daddy's lap because I was no longer a little girl. I was no longer 4, 5, or 6, but now I'm 10. And the correction officers would say, I can't sit on his lap or I can't kiss him on the lip anymore. I remember Ted Bundy teaching me how to write my name. I remember John Spinkelink, which is one of the first to be executed. I remember us going out there early morning before his execution, trying to be there with his family as a support. Wow. I remember the calls. And Daddy would call on the phone on a Sunday after we visited or during the week. The calls were very short, but the calls were memorable. I remember as I grew up and life got hard, entering into the foster care system after my grandparents were murdered. My grandmother, his mother, died in my arms, and he had to be told by my family that both of his parents, the day after his birthday, September the 1st, 1979, was his birthday. And that night, excuse me, that night, I woke to a lot of commotion. I woke to screaming. And back then, it wasn't a 911. It was a 630 number. I was 8 years old. And I woke up out of my sleep September the 2nd to the commotion of them trying to get the police, the ambulance. And I didn't understand what was happening until I got to the screen door. And I looked out and I saw my grandfather, the man who always protected me, murder my mom, the only mother I knew. I remember I couldn't get out of that door. Felt like if I got out that door, I could protect her. But I didn't know why I had to protect her, and the door would not open. The screen door would not open, and me trying to get out the door and the commotion of everyone behind me trying to get help. And I watched as he hit her with his car and she went into the grass. And then she got up and he put his car in park and he unloaded his gun and he killed my mother, which was Clifford's grandmother. And I finally got the door open. And when he saw me, he backed out and he left. And I went out there and she felt so hard that her wig went off of her head. And I said, Mama, Mama, you told me you wouldn't leave me. I'm 8 years old. She's bleeding. And I said, Mama, Mama, you promised me that you would be here. And she said, I love before she can get you out. She died in my arms. And later on, he being my grandfather, was found murdered. And my dad, when he got the news, he told me this. He said, where is Tracy? And they said she was there with blood all over her because she wouldn't leave Mama. Because Mama was always there for me. And that was one of the most difficult times in my father's life. Because the only person who I felt had his back, had my back, was now gone. So here at 8, a double homicide, double funeral. And then to go and stay with relatives where I had to deal with abuse. And I dealt with that abuse until I entered the foster care system. At that time, my sister, who was only 22, took custody of me. And she raised me and she continued to take us to see Daddy, and she continued to be Mama in Daddy's life. She continued to make sure he was okay. Matter of fact, she's the one he came home to, and I tried to get him to go with me to Miami, and he said, I gotta stay with little bit, baby.
Little bit. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Tracy Williams Magwood. She's the daughter of Clifford Williams. He was wrongfully convicted, spent more than 4 decades behind bars, and was eventually exonerated. He died in January. We're also joined by family pastor, Bishop Harry Williams II. I know that this is a very difficult family story, but after Clifford Williams was exonerated and released, he came to your church, and you formed kind of an instant connection with him. Tell us about that.
Of course. First of all, I was privileged to know him. I call him Pop. That was his nickname. I never really called him by his first name. It was always Pop. He came. We had an opportunity to get to know him through Tracy, Miss Magwood, as well as one of my deacons, Deacon Dana. And we instantly formed a relationship, and I wanted to be there for him as much as I could. So I remember taking him to the department store, getting him his first suit, and how proud he was to, you know, to get measured, to go through that whole process. And I felt like that. I felt like it was my father, being that I lost my father a couple of years prior, and so to have him, to be around him, to talk to him. And one of the things that stood out the most about him is that he wasn't angry with anyone. He never talked about his situation. He just was happy to be home. He was always smiling. I would run into him at the barbershop. We would always talk. Once a week, we'd go to the barbershop. I'd see him. We'd talk. When he came to the church, everybody just embraced him like that was their father. And I remember people coming around and just being a blessing to him. We didn't want him to have to go through anything financially, you know. So we know that coming home, as we deal with, you know, a lot of people coming home from being incarcerated after a while, we wanted to lighten that burden as much as we could. And so we were just honored to just be around him.
What are some of the, you've worked with other returning citizens, people who've been incarcerated and have come back home, other than, you know, financial support, what kind of special needs do they have, either emotionally or spiritually?
Oh, yeah. You know, like all of us, you know, we deal with certain things. And what I try to do is, you know, listen and to see exactly, you know, where their heart is. And after listening to them, being able to just hook them up with any services that we think that they may need. Everybody need is different. You know, some folks just want you to just hear them out. You know, some folks need, you know, it may be a place to stay. And so what we do, we hook them up with any of our partners that may be operating in areas of need, and we just join them together. We have people that, you know, me being from Jacksonville, I remember one of my old friends that I grew up with, he was incarcerated, and he said to me, he say, Harry, he say, man, your name is on the prison, in the prison on the wall. He said, so if anybody's getting out, they know to give you a call, you know. So so we don't have anything formally that we've set up, you know. We just, that's just what we do, you know. We try to be there for them.
We are talking about the we're talking about the legacy of Clifford Williams. He was released from prison in 2019 after more than four decades behind bars. We're talking with his daughter Tracy and his pastor Bishop Henry Williams, Harry Williams, I'm sorry. And we welcome your calls and comments. If you want to reach out, you can call 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. Ms. Tracy.
Bishop is being modest. I've seen him drive returning citizens around to fill out applications, take his own money, and help pay their parole fees. He would literally put deposits, not from the church, out of he and his wife's pocket, for those that needed to rent a rooming house, take them, move them. So he's being a little modest. He has volunteered countless hours working with my kids who are in the juvenile justice that are coming back from programs where they've been high risk. He's helped them get employment. He's helped them get clothing. Some, he's even helped with food. Every week, a second Wednesday of the month, he and many of the members, not just the members, but he partners with them to give food to the community. And he's done this with kids who are coming out of the juvenile justice programs that may not have the resources to eat, the resources to get clothes. So, and he's been a little modest, if I may say. He does above and beyond. And he's one, to me, an unsung hero.
So you have, since your father was released, I mean, there were a few priorities that kind of had to happen. You know, people who are wrongfully convicted are entitled by state law to compensation for the time that they've spent. And that's capped out at $2 million based on a calculation of how long people typically serve when they're wrongfully incarcerated. Your father's time was far longer than the average 8 years. He was there for 44 years. But he was not entitled initially to compensation because he had a prior record. Explain what you had to do in the months after his release to try to make sure that he did receive compensation for his wrongful conviction.
Well, I would like to say that my cousin, Nathan Myers, he was awarded his finances, but he didn't have peace knowing that his uncle was not going to get anything. So Nathan took the lead before the various political officials in Tallahassee. And then you had people like Shelley Thibodeau and people like Larry and...
We should explain Shelley Thibodeau runs the state attorney's office.
Yes,
conviction integrity unit.
Right.
And she was largely responsible for investigating your father's case and yes, getting him out of prison.
Yes.
And Larry? And
Larry is one of the attorneys that worked with...
the Innocence Project of Florida.
And also worked with getting my dad his compensation.
Okay.
They served as advocates. And I want to, and I'm drawing a blank on one of the attorneys, Mark, attorney Larry Seller and attorney Mark Barrett, I believe that's his name. They both worked so diligently with my dad's case, along with the Florida Innocent Project. They advocated, they rallied. You came to Tallahassee and supported us there on our crusade to get Daddy compensated.
It was a long road.
It was a very long road, and it was a road that we traveled while going through the cancer. I stood before the House of Representatives, Kim Daniels. She was not just his biggest supporter in getting these fundings.
State Representative.
State Representative Kim Daniels. She also served as a support to me and to our family. She continued to believe that it was possible. And so the journey was long. It was tiring. I spent money that I didn't have traveling from South Florida to Jacksonville to pick him up, to take him to Tallahassee, to bring him back, to go back to Miami, just so that we could have our story heard. And in hearing our story, we got so much support from both parties.
It was
really Republicans and the Democrats.
Very bipartisan and really overwhelming support.
Yes. And they supported us and they stood with us until Daddy was given his compensation. So I'm indebted to so many people who thought it not robbery to just help my dad during our time.
At the time you lived in Miami, you live in Jacksonville now, but remind us, you know, in the months after his release, you tried to kind of rebuild and restore some of the moments that you had not been able to share with your dad growing up. Birthdays that were missed. You know, he was not able to walk you down the aisle or be there for your graduations. But there were opportunities to create some special moments. So tell us about what you did in Miami.
April the 14th, 2019. Was the first dance I ever had with my daddy. It was the first dance that he held me in his arms. And he said to me, "It's all right, baby. I'm not going nowhere." And I cried on his shoulder. I cried on his shoulder because it was Daddy's little girl's moment, a moment that I was held by my father. Because I was held before, but it was held by people who victimized me, people that were supposed to protect me, being that I lost my dad, but they hurt me. And Daddy told me it was going to be all right. So that day in Miami at a church where they celebrated my 48th birthday, it was the day that my life was forever changed. I got to dance with my daddy. My children got to see me dance. He wasn't there for my wedding day to walk me down the aisle. He wasn't there for the birth of his first grandchild. He wasn't there to see me graduate from college. He wasn't there to see me overcome life challenges and yet say how good God is. He wasn't there when I got ordained as a minister of the gospel to preach Jesus, the one who became so real to me. Because when I didn't have daddy, when I didn't have mama, I had God. And my family wasn't a real religious family. So God was very personal to me. He was near and dear to my heart. And I am so grateful that I got to share that moment with you. I remember his exoneration. There were so many news reporters, but there was something different about you. It wasn't like you were there just to get a story, but you wanted to tell a story. And I felt a connection with you, Ann. And it was you who I felt compelled to share that moment with me. You interviewed my son that day. And it was that day that my son said, to see my mom dance with her dad can never repay all the years that she lost. But this moment was memorable.
Well, thank you for that. Obviously, I have, you know, followed your story closely, and it really is a, you know, a difficult, compelling story. But you are now looking to turn that into a mission. You're creating a foundation in your father's name, or have created a foundation, Clifford Williams.
I will. Yes,
yeah. Ma'am. Talk about some of the goals and the pillars of that effort that you want to try to accomplish.
So because Bishop Harry's ministry was the first place that Daddy came to, it was the first place that embraced him. Again, remember, he wasn't going to be compensated. So when they took him under their wings, they took him under their wings because they truly just loved him. And so I want to partner with In the Word Ministries to start the foundation of Clifford Williams and focus on four pillars of society, one being scholarships. When I first went to college and I never felt I would be able to, I just had a desire. I had to take out student loans. Many children of incarcerated parents don't have the resources. Oftentimes they're forgotten about. Oftentimes they don't have a support system. So I want to be able to start a scholarship foundation that not only a person who may have a parent that's incarcerated or may have come out of the prison system will have fundings. They will have mentorship in the sense of someone in their field taking them under their wings and seeing them from the genesis of their college years to the exodus of those years. I want to also start mentorship. Mentorship is something that Bishop Harry and his ministry has already started with youthful offenders coming home from programs or being placed on probation. Oftentimes having mentors to help you and to believe in you. First-time offenders who come in contact with the judicial system and preventing them from further involvement.
I want to just pause for a second. We have a call. Omar from Jacksonville, welcome to First Coast Connect. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I wanted to commend both of you all and you also for presenting this or having this on the radio. This system of mass incarceration, cattle slavery that they have going on, is going to take a lot to combat because they are actively taking money away from schools so that they can keep that pipeline flowing. And I see in my children's schools, teachers are leaving left and right. So I am so disheartened and concerned, but I just wanted to commend you both on what you're doing to try to help combat the system that they have set up. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for the call, Omar. I think we also missed a call, but we had a message from Eric in Arlington. He said he has a son in the Duval County Jail with mental health issues. And for people who have children, we tend to feel like there's nothing we can do, but he wants to commend Ms. Tracy for taking this and making it a beautiful story.
I want to say to Eric, there are so many like his son. And that is one of my desires. As you know, my son worked in the correctional field, and so many of them deal with trauma, PTSD, deal with mental illnesses, and they are placed in incarcerated rather than getting treatment. And what we do is we recycle them through the judicial system. So Eric, yes, I want to get my dad's foundation started so that we can mirror what I saw in Key West. In Key West, in the Monroe Sheriff County jail, they had mental illness treatment as a part of their sentencing. Instead of locking them away, they gave them mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, and they would appear before a judge every so many months where their case was heard, and they would be released back into the community. I would love to see that here in Duval County. I work as a probation officer, and so many of our children start as juveniles that are mentally challenged, but that challenge goes untreated. Illnesses go untreated. They become adults, and as adults, they enter into the judicial system, and they're fathered through that prison pipeline that Omar spoke about. And being here in Jacksonville for me was not just to return to be with my father, but to serve as an advocate and to help bring change to this system that I feel has failed so many, Anne.
Well, you have such a powerful story, Tracy. If people want to get more information or to know about how they can help as you establish the foundation, where could they find that information?
Well, they can always reach out to In the Word International Ministries. They can always reach out to Bishop Harry, who is helping me pioneer this project. And definitely, and I'm looking to get the foundation started soon. I am still grieving my father's death. I still wake up at night crying. I still drive down the street and just want to be there with him. And so once I kind of overcome this stage of grief, I'm going to get the foundation up. My desire, again, we're starting it with no capital. We don't have the money, but it's with our personal finances. So if anyone's interested in getting behind us, rallying with us, we welcome it. They can reach out to Bishop Harry and the In the Word Ministry, and he can give you that information.
Well, Tracy Williams Magwood, Bishop Harry Williams II, thank you both so much for being here, for sharing Clifford Williams' story and your own story, and for talking about the work that you plan to do. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you all for having us.
Thank you. Up next, are they going to need a bigger boat? We talk with shark researchers ahead of their month-long expedition in search of the great white. Welcome back. Chasing sharks is not for the faint of heart, but for researchers at Jacksonville-based OSearch, it's both a passion and a scientific priority. I'm joined now by Chris Fisher, OSearch founder and expedition leader. Chris, welcome.
Thanks, Anne. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. So you're about to embark on a month-long ocean voyage. What are you looking for?
Well, you live in a very special place there in Jacksonville, where the new OSearch global headquarters is currently being built at Jacksonville University. It's the wintering range of our white sharks that live off our east coast that stretch between Newfoundland up in Atlantic Canada and the Gulf of Mexico. And it appears that from the data we're receiving from the sharks that they're likely mating in this region this time of year. So we're actually trying to collect enough data to see if that's the case and to prove that. So that's the particular mission of this expedition. Our data currently indicates from hormone levels we've received from the blood samples from the big males and the big females in early March, we found that they were about 60% to fully ripe and ready to mate in early March off this region. And we're not quite sure if that was they were coming down from mating or if they were working their way up to mating. So we weren't sure if it was before March or after March. And so this is an April 1st trip with a real hope to see some mature animals and get some blood samples from both mature males and females, as well as semen samples from the males, so we can make sure if they're viable. That's the real goal, is to, for the first time in history, identify the mating site of one of the 9 populations of white sharks around the world.
So this is Voyage 47 for you, I believe, this expedition northbound.
This will be the 47th expedition I've led around the world, and the team has performed.
And you, before getting into shark research, you had a really successful TV show on ESPN called Offshore Adventures. Then you kind of pivoted to ocean conservation. Explain how it is that you got into, trying to research sharks in particular.
Well, when we were making Offshore Adventures back from the late 90s up till about 2009, we were moving primarily across the Pacific, and, we were young. Captain Brett, who's been with me on the water now, Brett McBride, he's the most gifted waterman I've ever been around. Since the late 90s, we've been on the water together, and we're about the same age. And so we were doing offshore adventures, and it was great. We were pouring the world's oceans into people's lives. The noble goal when I began was to pour the world's oceans into people's lives at a scale unseen since Cousteau. That was the goal. I felt like since when he had passed that there was a void. And so I began offshore adventures in an effort to do that. While I was doing it, we started to see that, the scientists were tasked with basically an impossible job. They go to school, they learn about their area of discipline in science, and then they're just kind of let loose out in the world, and they're supposed to be able to go collect the data to publish the papers we need to manage sport abundance and make sure our kids see a robust future in the ocean. But no one really teaches them how to run a boat, how to catch whatever they're studying, how to collect the data. So there was this gap we saw with scientists struggling to collect data. Meanwhile, we were out on the ocean catching and releasing the things they wanted to study to make TV shows. And it just didn't make any sense to me. And I started to dig into it, and there was a disconnect between the fishermen and the scientists, the lack of trust. Everybody had lost sight of our grandchildren in the discussion and the ocean in the discussion. And so I began to try to build a common vision that was based around an ocean first, great grandchildren first disposition. And I went to Brett and I said, "Hey, Brett, these guys need help." Oftentimes, many people in the space will say they believe that the full-time watermen on the ocean are about 30 years ahead of the science and understanding what's going on out there. And so I was like, we got to help close this gap, because he and I were just starting to have families. We were just starting to have kids. And the fishing had changed for us, the experience on the water. And I was like, man, we got to do more. And so we started helping the people who studied the stuff we were catching on the show. So if you saw us down in Central America catching billfish and things like that, at the time we weren't smart enough to put the science forward. But after we would do what we were doing to make the show, we would have the scientists come in and tag animals. And we radically accelerated the rate at which they could collect data. In an environment where the science community is saying the biggest challenge for the future of the ocean is data deficit, right? So we had overcome the capacity to collect data by just bringing the world-class skills of professional watermen together with scientists on a common vision that was great-grandchildren and ocean first, and forget about who's the scientist, forget about who's the fisherman, let's just get this done.
Go ahead.
Well, and so when we started to help those people, the science community actually came to us and said, "It's great you're helping us with these pelagic fish, these billfish and other species, but if we don't fix our large shark problem, there will be no billfish, there will be no tuna." And I was like, "So you mean this lifestyle that we love so much, which is basically getting families out on the water to love it and enjoy it, won't exist if we don't fix this large shark problem?" And they came to me and they said, "Yeah, and there's no data on these large sharks. They're too big. We can't catch them. We can't leverage the latest technology to figure out where they're mating and birthing and the nurseries are. And we're down to 9% of our large sharks." and we're seeing the ecosystems begin to collapse. And when I asked, I said, well, who's working on the sharks? They just said there's no one who has the capacity to handle these big animals. And I like to simplify things. And I looked at him and I said, are you trying to tell me that if we don't fix this large shark problem, my great-grandchildren and everyone else's won't be able to go out and catch a fish and eat a fresh fish sandwich? And they looked at me and they said, yes. And when I looked around the space, I didn't really see anyone else with the opportunity to pivot. We were really good at catching big things and letting them go alive. And so we pivoted. We pivoted from the shiny white boat, the yacht, and the gourmet galley, you know, to a big metal ship and research and exploration and science to enable these scientists to collect data much, much faster and on things they can't collect data from so that we could manage toward abundance really in an effort to make sure our grandkids can see an operating ocean. Because if the ocean's not operating, we're dead on land, right? It's all our water. It's 2/3 of our air. And that's why, I mean, I'm not a shark guy. I'm an abundance guy. And it's just the path to abundance goes through the apex predator. And that's where we're making a historic difference right now.
We have just about a minute left, but if you can tell us, you've really transformed how the public accesses and interacts with data. How has that been central to the work that you're doing?
Well, that was totally disruptive when we began. People were very upset at us in the science community back in 2012 and 13 when we began to open source the data, because that was another problem with the structure of how we do ocean research. It was all being hidden. People were trying to hide their data and leverage it to get ahead of one another. And in the end, it's going to take us all. So because we were funding the work, we were able to disrupt these old norms and open source the data and include the public in the most charismatic research project in the ocean in the world right now. I mean, we're solving the life history puzzle of our great white shark populations. And that was transformational. It allowed the public into the science space. It was no longer about the ivory tower. They began to care. They began to get involved and understand. And it really changed the conversation around sharks. Because we knew we had to not only solve the puzzle, they had an image problem, right? We had to help people understand how important their role was and why they're so important. And that was a big part of open sourcing the data and also open sourcing, communicating with the sharks about the sharks and speaking to people how all of us who aren't in the academic space speak. So it's been hugely important because in the end, it's going to take us all.
Well, Chris Fisher, we know that the OSearch facility is due to start getting underway in Mayport soon. We appreciate your work and joining us today, and we'll look forward to hearing about when you come back from Voyage 47.
Yeah, thank you. We are so excited about the new Global World Headquarters down in Mayport. The people that came together to make that happen was really unbelievable. You know, it was actually Mayport's idea to bring OSearch there. Bill Gullerford from the city council brought us down there. And then Duggan and Yarborough over in Tallahassee, they really battled for the economic development of the region, and we're grateful and thrilled.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much. We appreciate it. And stick around. We'll be right back with what you need to put on your calendar in the week ahead.
The Jacksonville Symphony presents Bizet's Carmen, directed by Gregory Keller with international guest vocalists, April 12th and 14th. Visit jacksymphony.org.
On the next Florida Roundup, the Atlantic Ocean is a lot warmer than usual. The tropic temperatures now are about as high as they would be in June, and scientists are worried. And it's an ominous sign for hurricane season, and for Florida's coral reefs still recovering from last year's marine heat wave. Email your questions and comments about the impact of a warming Atlantic to radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Join me Friday at noon.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Nancy Nichols talks about American women and cars, which she says became our most gendered technology. Women weren't considered qualified to drive cars, but they were used to advertise them. Cars were mostly designed for male bodies, she writes, in ways that put women drivers at risk. Her book is Women Behind the Wheel. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
When a caseworker from Child Protective Services shows up at the door, it can be a crucial turning point for families. Children in dire circumstances might soon get the help they need, or families might be unnecessarily torn apart. Both outcomes are common in the broken child welfare system. Former CPS caseworker Jessica Price has a few ideas for change and joins us next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm David Luckin. On the next Electro Lounge, we've got Brandy Younger, weather report, and music from Cafe Del Mar. Electro Lounge, Saturday at 10 p.m., only on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. It's Thursday, and it's time for a look ahead at the weekend ahead. So we're joined now by our guide to all things art and culture, Yaya Cardona. Welcome, Yaya.
Buenos dias on this rainy morning.
It is a rainy one.
I know.
Did you hit traffic? Or?
No, thank God I didn't. Not yet. But the thing about yesterday was really bad, and I had to leave exactly when it was lightning and thundering, and you had to see how me and Mambo were praying.
We do have Mambo back today.
Yes, he's back. He's in his little bag hiding right now. We'll get him out in a little bit.
Our doll. Well, so what's cooking this week, Yaya?
Bueno, let's start with tomorrow, Friday. Tomorrow, Friday, I want to talk about, first of all, my first little gig as the first Hispanic coordinator, Hispanic outreach coordinator for the city of Jacksonville.
Title?
There we go. The Mexican Chamber is hosting a free public event in City Hall tomorrow. They're celebrating their 8th annual Cesar Chavez Day, where they come and honor Hispanic leaders here. Mayor Donna Deegan is going to be giving a little speech. So check that out if you have nothing to do tomorrow from 10:30 in the morning in City Hall, right there in the first floor.
Terrific. Okay. A great champion for workers' rights.
Yes, 100%. And let's talk about the unveil of Eve Out East on 818 Phillips Randolph. That's going to be tomorrow, Friday, for free at 6 p.m. Business owners, muralists, bartenders, chefs, residents of the historic Eastside community have planned an evening of food, drinks, art, and entertainment. This community takes, this event will take place, like I said, at the A. Phillips Randolph Boulevard. They have been doing something every single Friday lately. So check them out. Shout out to Dawn and her team.
The historic Eastside community, or Out East is their.
Yeah, Out East.
This was, I mean, it's really taking off. They're doing a ton of events, and this is going to have, you know, one end of APR to the other.
Rightfully so.
Events.
So check that out.
Yeah.
Now, have you been to the Amplified Avondale in St.
Have
John's?
Have not. What is this?
Oh, my God. It's like their version of Art Walk. It's the last Friday of every month, and it's coming back this Friday, tomorrow Friday, for the 2024 season. This is a monthly event, like I said, where musicians, DJs, art pops up. Good vibes in general. Check it out.
Kind of inside and outside, like by Casbah Cafe.
And Mellow Mushroom. They have a kids zone, so it's kid friendly. They have fire dancers.
Oh, awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's
I'm going to be there tomorrow, Friday, because I don't know how to stay still. And I want to talk about this Saturday, my festival, Art in the Park.
Yes, let's talk about it.
I am so excited with my partner in crime, Liz McCoy, the director of James Weldon Johnson Park.
So this is the park across from your new home at City Hall.
Yes.
Yeah, downtown. Front.
I know. That's so crazy. It's going to be this Friday is our fourth annual chalk art competition. This year's theme is Under the Sea.
Yeah. Mermaids?
Yes.
Starfish?
All of the above.
SpongeBob?
Yes. And every year grows more and more. We literally have 50 artists total participating.
Real artists.
Real artists. Well, you know, I call them real artists.
I mean, the stuff is beautiful.
100%.
This is chalk art.
We have an elementary category, middle school category, high school category, and adult category. So make sure you come on out, get your token, vote for your favorite artwork. And, you know, support them. And I know you guys want to talk to the artists, so just be a little bit, you know, cautious that they are working. So talk with them for like 1 or 2 minutes, but follow them on Instagram and, you know, they're great people, but let them work. I just want to say let them work.
What time does this get rolling?
From 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. completely free. We have Pine School Elementary going out there doing a dance performance at 1:30. DJ XL, a live credit union will have an activity on their tent. And thank you to PNC Bank as well for being our sponsor. So check that out, Art in the Park, this Saturday for free, 12 p.m. to 5 p.m.
So this next event, I think, really speaks to your buddy.
Mambito.
Right? Because he is our resident fashionista.
Yes, that's going to be here in WJCT Studios is Unlock Your Fashion Intellect Fashion Show. If you're a fashionista like me and Mambito, all right, this is the event that you need to come to at the Soundstage this Saturday at 2 p.m. All right, Savage Nerd is hosting a fashion extravaganza. There'll be vendors, all kind of vendors here.
Mima's Soul Food is catering, right? And our own Mr. Alpete from Alpete's Neighborhood is going to be here. Playing music.
And, you know, shout out to LP because he's also going to be an art walk this Wednesday coming at James Weldon Johnson Park. They're doing like a VIP lounge on stage, which is free. But he is the resident DJ right now.
Excellent.
So check that out. That's going to be art walk. So shout out to LP. But again, this is this Saturday, Unlock Your Fashion Intellect Fashion Show here at WJCT. The fashion show itself begins at 4 p.m. Now, I don't know if you know, baseball like runs deep in my veins. My uncle played for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Yeah, in the late 1970s, 1980s. And now he is very well known in Puerto Rico, obviously, for his baseball. And
what's his name?
Heriberto Vargas.
Okay.
Heriberto Vargas, tío, I love you. And now he is a baseball coach for University in NYU. Bueno, I'm saying that because the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp kick off their season.
Wow.
And I'm excited.
Who doesn't love a little baseball?
Oh, my God. Listen, I love it. I don't know how people say it's boring. It's not a boring sport, people. Again, the boring only get bored. So come on out to the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp starting this Friday.
6:35, Saturday and 3 p.m. Sunday.
Yes.
We're going to have to leave it there.
Yes.
But we can always get more information
at createjax.com, C-R-E-8-Jax.com, and follow me on Instagram, YayaLoveJax.
All right. Well, that's our program. Join us again tomorrow. We're going to be talking with our Week in Review panel about the biggest headlines of the week. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.